This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Ontario school boards are suing several social media giants.
The lawsuits from the TDSB, TCDSB, Peel District School Board, and Ottawa Carleton District School Board were filed separately in Ontario Superior Court. They accuse Meta, Snapchat, and TikTok of disrupting student learning. They also claim social media has rewired the way children think, behave, and learn, leaving educators and schools to manage the fallout. The lawsuits are seeking $4.5 billion and are believed to be the first of their kind in Canada.
Concerns about the impact of social media on youth have been brewing for a long time, but in recent months, a new battleground has emerged. The courts, who are home to lawsuits launched by school boards that seek billions in compensation and demand that social media giants change their products to better protect kids. Those lawsuits have now come to Canada, with four Ontario school boards recently filing claims. Robert Diab is a professor of law at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, BC. He writes about constitutional and human rights, as well as topics in law and technology. He joins me on the podcast to provide a comparison between Canadian and U.S. developments, a deep dive into alleged harms and legal arguments behind the claims, and an assessment of the likelihood of success. Robert, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I'm really glad you've taken the time to come on. As you know, and I'm sure many listeners know, concerns about the impact on social media on youth have been brewing for a long time, but it's in recent months that we've begun to see an escalation, I think, on both the legal and the regulatory fronts, notably with some proposed legislation and lawsuits that have been launched by school boards, especially in the United States, that seek billions in compensation and hope to force companies such as TikTok, Meta, Snap, and Google, the lead companies in this space, into changing their products. Now, these efforts have made their way north to Canada with a recent action launched by several school boards in Ontario and an on-again, off-again bill in British Columbia. Why don't we start with the cases, and we can weave in the legislative efforts a little bit as we go. Now, this might seem like it's come a little bit out of nowhere for some, but there is a history of similar kinds of litigation. So you can get us started maybe with a bit of context that help us situate the school board actions.
Yeah, Michael. So the first thing to say is that it isn't a novel action. It follows upon what are probably now something like 400 to 500 U.S. Cases by school boards against the same defendants, beginning with a board in Seattle over a year ago. And they're all making essentially the same claim that social media companies have designed highly addictive products that are harmful to the mental health of young people whose brains are still developing and are more susceptible to manipulation. It's had an impact on their behavior, their attention, their mental health. This has caused school boards to spend substantial amounts of additional money to address the fallout of this, hiring additional staff, spending more time responding to conflict. And they're seeking damages to cover these costs. They're also trying to compel the platforms to alter the design and function of their algorithms. So the companies have responded to the claims down south by saying that social media are only one of various factors affecting teen anxiety or well-being today. Other things they point to include climate change and gun violence. These external anxieties are driving engagement. If anything, they say that, you know, young people are turning to the apps for sources of news or information or clarity on things that concern them. They also say that they've taken reasonable steps to make their platform safe in various ways. They've implemented age and time restrictions. They've acted on harmful content when it's reported. But of course, the argument in response is that the ongoing addiction, the mental health issues, the misbehavior they're seeing in schools that is closely tied or correlated in various ways with the apps proves that the measures haven't been adequate. So that's one, you know, one body of precedent, you could say. Another really important precedent is the vaping litigation. So roughly 5 years ago, over 100 school boards in the US sued makers of e-cigarettes on the basis that the product was negligently designed and caused a public nuisance. A public nuisance is a civil action for interference with the use and enjoyment of something over which one has a public right, like traveling a public road. So the boards have claimed that vaping interfered with a young person's right to clean air and a healthy environment at school. The interference caused the boards to incur costs to monitor vaping. Courts in the U.S. Did find that e-cigarette makers owed a duty of care to the board, and that kind of set in motion various settlements. One that stands out is Juul, the e-cigarette maker Juul, settled a number of lawsuits, but one of them was an over $1 billion settlement with a group of school boards for claims involving negligence and public nuisance. So that was an important precedent for these school boards. Another kind of important piece of the context here is that some 42 states' attorneys general are suing Meta on the more specific basis that its platforms make use of algorithms designed to foster addiction and that they target teens and children. These suits highlight as harmful features like the infinite scroll that makes it harder to disengage, haptics and notifications that interfere with sleep, visual filters known to contribute to body dysmorphia, even things like likes and like counts, which are known to have a negative effect on young people by inviting unflattering comparisons. They say that Meta has been aware since at least the early 2010s of a strong correlation between time spent on its platforms and depression, self-harm, low self-esteem for teens, and that it has downplayed or denied or concealed this. Oh, so, okay, so then maybe one last, you know, piece of the context is there are a number of class actions in the U.S. and at least a couple in Canada brought by parents of children who have committed suicide as a result of cyberbullying or the foregrounding of suicidal content on social media. And so there are those various things going on that this drew upon.
Okay. I mean, that's really helpful context. So we're dealing, you know, with a large number of cases in the United States for which it sounds like there is some amount of precedent, at least with them in the e-cigarette litigation with respect to school boards trying to use the courts to obtain both compensation and effect some amount of change, and you know, and a number of other legal avenues that are being pursued to try to address the concerns around perceived harms from social media services. So we're seeing a lot of these kinds of cases. What specifically are the harms that are being alleged in the cases in Ontario?
Well, so the general claim is that the defendants have carefully designed the platforms to be highly addictive. Everything from the placement and color of buttons, the shape of the interface, the timing of notifications, to the algorithmic feeds, all of it being intended to induce compulsive and excessive use among teens. The Ontario claims go into a lot of detail about how the platforms are harmful and addictive. The primary sort of set of features relates to the algorithms. So they point to things like Snap and TikTok using the infinite scroll, showing the most sort of statistically stimulating content, combined with features like autoplay, no breaks, full screen videos, all designed to keep you in a near hypnotic state, they say. They use variable reward schedule. They show you engaging video at certain intervals so as to keep you kind of hanging on for another dopamine hit, just that you've been trained to anticipate. The suit says that this is especially effective against young people whose prefrontal cortex is still developing. The algorithms are designed to have a negative content bias, to show you more outrage, more embarrassment, more violence. They involve preference amplification. They sort of send you down rabbit holes based on your user history, showing you more of what you like. The claim singles out Meta and TikTok for knowingly boosting suicidal and self-injury content. But all four defendants, Meta, Snap, Google for YouTube, and and TikTok are alleged to boost contact involving self-harm, drugs, alcohol, eating disorders, hate speech, non-consensual sexual activity. It also points out the claims how over time the various platforms have shown more and more algorithmic contact rather than people you follow, culminating in the case of TikTok, which shows you something like 90 to 95% algorithmic content. So among other significant harms worth noting is the claim that the platforms have allowed themselves to become forums for cyberbullying, harassment, or child sexual abuse material. They have failed to police accounts that host this kind of material that allow them to garner large followings, or have kind of automatically pointed to similar content. They haven't employed effective age verification for those under 13. All of this facilitates connections between children and sex predators. The suit cites a 2020 finding that Instagram hosted some 500,000 underage accounts involving inappropriate interactions with children, suggesting that Meta hasn't been effective in protecting child safety. So has it led to addiction? Like what are the stats there? One set of stats that stood out to me is that 91% of Ontario students in high school use social media daily. 31% of those use it for 5 hours or more a day, and 14% of them use it for 7 hours or more a day, which just seems staggering. And so if you put that together with, the well-documented correlation between the amount of time spent per day on social media and the likelihood of experiencing depression and anxiety, especially, an effect especially noticeable for teenage girls, you've got, I think, strong evidence of harm. And this is precisely what the Ontario boards are reporting. They're saying that they're seeing more incidents of behavioral dysregulation, learning and intention issues, more crucially, a mental health crisis, they say, like a significant increase in rates of anxiety, depression, body dysmorphia, low self-esteem, loneliness, self-harm, etc. And as a consequence, they're seeing rising rates of physical violence and conflict, assaults, sexual assaults, cyberbullying, property damage, and the boards are obliged to respond to this. So they've had to hire, they say, more social workers, more counselors, more safety monitors, more vice principals and other administrators. So those are the harms that they're alleging.
Okay, that's a long list. Some of these certainly will be, I think, familiar to just about anyone listening that's on social media, certainly in terms of how they've structured their products and how people actively engage and use them. The implications are the kinds of things that people don't always think about, though, and clearly you've highlighted some of those. So if those are the harms, what are the legal causes of action that the board is seeking to raise to sort of to bring this forward as a piece of litigation?
Yeah, they're making three claims: general negligence, product liability, and public nuisance. And we can go into the details about what each of those involve in a second. But one important element of their argument for how these causes of action are made out in this case relates to the Ontario Education Act. So they're pointing to a set of specific duties the Act imposes on school boards as being an important thing that the social media companies and their impact on students has interfered with their ability to carry out these duties. It's worth noting some of them specifically just to lend a flavor of this. So the Act charges school boards with promoting student achievement and well-being, promoting a positive school environment that is inclusive, promoting the prevention of bullying, overseeing the effective stewardship of the board's resources. And incidentally, the Supreme Court of Canada in the mid-90s also affirmed that school boards have a duty to maintain a positive school environment. So floating in the background, or at least you could say a basis for the argument that social media companies owe school boards a duty of care, is this notion that if they aren't held liable for harms that are at play here, then school boards have no other way of addressing the interference to their fulfillment of these duties.
Do these companies owe to the boards? I understand that the boards have legislative responsibilities, and they're going to make the case that these companies are impeding, in effect, their ability to meet those obligations. But how do these companies get roped in? How do these companies find themselves in the midst of this kind of litigation with some sort of duty to the boards themselves?
You're right. I mean, that's really what I think it comes down to in large part. So just to remind listeners, to make out a negligence claim, the plaintiff has to prove the defendant owed them a duty of care, the defendant's conduct breached a standard of care, the plaintiff sustained damage, and the damage was caused by the defendant's breach. So the key here will be establishing that these social media companies owe not just students a duty of care, because that they have a direct relationship, they're users of the product and so on, but why do they owe boards a duty of care? So if they do, this would be the recognition of a novel duty of care. And the test for that in Canada involves establishing that the defendant was in a proximate relationship to the plaintiff and could or should have foreseen that they could be harmed by their actions. So one question here would be, could social media companies foresee harm to school boards if students' mental health or behavior were affected by the use of the apps? And in some cases, courts have inferred proximity from foreseeability. So if foreseeability is made out, then there we go. But if they go on to pose the proximity question, it's a broader test. The test there would then be, are the parties in such a close and direct relationship that it would be just and fair to impose a duty of care in law? And many factors can be considered here, but once again, this points back to the idea that the boards have a statutory duty to provide a safe learning environment, to foster learning and so forth. So that might be factored in. But the explicit argument that the boards are making in the claim as to why the defendants are in a sufficiently proximate relationship and why the harms why harm is foreseeable to them, to the boards in particular, not just to the students, is that from their internal research, the defendants have been aware of the risk that their products would cause compulsive use among children and teens, and they aim to bring this about. They knew that students would be using the products during the day because, they kind of marketed them to be used in that way. They knew that this would be disruptive to their education, and they ought to have foreseen that school boards would incur additional costs as a consequence of harms, flowing from this, that they'd have to hire more staff, they'd have to, have additional administrative and investigation costs for the cyberbullying conflict issues and so on. So, but maybe the bigger point to emphasize here is that recognizing a new duty of care involves a policy dimension. It's the question is it just and fair to impose a new duty of care? And the boards are saying, look, we're affected in a different way from other members of the public. Like maybe parents are affected if their children engage in compulsive behavior, but we're in a different position because we've got this statutory and common law mandate to run schools, in a healthy way or create a healthy environment. And so yes, students alone could sue as a class, but it wouldn't address the interference to the school environment, to the right to an education. So the board is the right plaintiff. So assuming there is a duty of care, how did the social media companies breach the standard of care? That may be just worth explaining very briefly. What should a reasonable social media company look like? Like what ought they have done? And the answer is they should do things like Well, first of all, they shouldn't design them to be harm their apps to be harmful and addictive. They should be testing new features before and after their release to ensure they're safe. They should warn students of known dangers. They should be more effective in removing or precluding harmful conduct. So that's how they've breached the standard. And of course, causation is made out in the ways we've mentioned, the higher rates of anxiety, misbehavior, depression, et cetera, and the damage the board has made out through the additional resources. The claim for product liability is fairly similar. The product has all these harmful effects, and the measures taken haven't been adequate. Ineffective, insufficiently effective parental controls, for example, allowing all this child's sex abuse material to be, or allowing so much of it to be, to continue to be there on the platforms and so forth. Maybe more interestingly, and perhaps maybe a stronger claim is the one in public nuisance. So briefly, just to refresh your memory about the definition, Supreme Court has defined a public nuisance as any activity which unreasonably interferes with the public interest in questions of health, safety, morality, comfort, or convenience. The essence of it, though, is an interference with the enjoyment of a right you hold as a member of the public. And the primary example, once again, is like protesters blocking a public road or a company polluting a stream. In both cases, it's your right to the enjoyment of the road or clean water, as a public right. And the claim here is that social media has interfered with students' public right to an education. And in their claim, the boards point to the right to an education in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which Canada ratified in 1991. So by the boards are saying that by marketing addictive and harmful products to students, the defendants have interfered with their public right to an education.
Okay, I mean it's a really fantastic breakdown of sort of the negligence claims, the product liability claims, and the public nuisance claims. It all of this does raise the question: what are the boards hoping to achieve here? Are they is it primarily about being made whole for the cost they say they've incurred in trying to deal with some of these harms, or is there more at play?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I suspect the boards will succeed in defending a summary dismissal motion, which we can come back to in a minute, how that's going to unfold. But I would be surprised if this doesn't result in a settlement. And so what would they be seeking? Well, yes, I think to begin with, to be made whole in terms of costs, to recover some portion of the additional funds they've had to pay. But they also want to see changes to the apps. They want to see, or to the way the apps function. They want maybe changes to the algorithms. Maybe, for example, the choice to opt out, or rules around what user data the apps can make use of. They want more better protections around the way children use the apps, like verified parental consent, no more anonymous accounts, maybe product warnings about known dangers. Also, out there is the idea that there should be more spent on raising digital literacy among students. And maybe social media should help fund this and be involved in it. So I think that those are the general contours of a settlement.
Okay, so they're looking for far more than money. They're looking for real changes in terms of how those products function. You mentioned off the top that there have been hundreds of these cases in the United States, starting in Seattle about a year ago. I guess that begs a couple of questions. One, what's been happening in the United States since those cases have been launched, and to what extent, if at all, do they differ from what we're seeing play out in Canada?
Yeah, so as to how they differ, my sense is that they, looking at the statements of claim in some of those cases, my sense is that they differ superficially, if at all. So the litany of harms or you know, ways that they contribute to compulsive use, etc. All of those claims are very similar across the actions. The differences seem to track differences in local tort law or statutory duties and protections. So, which isn't surprising, but that's how they differ. So, which is to say that is given that they are so similar in a substantial sense, I think once they begin to settle down there, or, you know, for example, if courts start to recognize at the summary dismissal motion stage that there may be a duty of care here, there may be, you know, this may be a faulty product, etc., that settlements will begin to be accelerated. But so, to my knowledge, no summary dismissal motions have been brought yet or heard yet in the United States, but apparently some are being heard in May. So we may, you know, we may hear about that very soon. As to the merits of a summary dismissal motion in the Ontario actions, yeah. So what is the test there? Again, your listeners may be well aware. On a motion to strike in Canada, the court assumes all the facts and the pleadings to be true. And the test is whether it is plain and obvious that the pleading discloses no reasonable cause of action. But the courts have held that when asking this question, the approach has to be generous and the court should err on the side of permitting a novel but arguable claim to proceed. So, you know, what are the merits here? Well, I think on the question of whether the social media companies owe a duty of care to school boards, I think there's at least an arguable claim. I expect that their action in general negligence would survive a summary dismissal motion because there's at least a policy argument in support of it. Social media companies are knowingly contributing to compulsive use, or at least, you know, there's an arguable claim there. And the impact on the boards was reasonably foreseeable. Similarly with product liability, that cause of action, there's, you know, there's an arguable case to say these products have had a harmful effect. You knew this, you had evidence pointing to this, just based on the strong correlation of use and mental health. The public nuisance claim, though, again, is the one that intrigues me more. I think it's the one that's least easily dismissible. You know, the question here is a child's right to an education like a public right to travel a public road? By contributing to the compulsive use of these apps, has social media interfered with a public right to an education in an analogous way to which protesters interfere with your right to travel a public road? Is the analogy a cogent one? And I think that it's at least arguable, or that it has an air of plausibility to it, which is all that it really needs at the summary dismissal stage. And, you know, if the Ontario boards can survive a summary dismissal motion, you know, if they can successfully fend that off, then they're sent along to a jury trial. It may be worth briefly mentioning, why is this not a class action? I took this up with lead counsel in the Ontario cases, Duncan Embry, and he explained to me that it's not a class action because the boards wanted to maintain kind of autonomy and control over their actions. They're directly, you know, answerable to their constituencies, and so they needed to maintain that. So they are actually individual actions just unfolding in parallel. And so so that means that they will be heard in jury trials in their various jurisdictions, although the interlocutory motions might be heard together. Another intriguing little detail about it is that they're asking for money damages in the claims, but they're not asking for injunctive relief. They're not asking that the court compel the companies to amend the algorithms, because injunctive relief, as Duncan explained to me, would take the actions out of the purview of a jury.
That's a really interesting insight, both in terms of some of the strategic choices that were made as part of the litigation here in Canada to try to ensure that there's a jury trial, to have a greater level of control. And it sounds like you think that both that this has a reasonable chance of surviving what will the likely attempt to try to stop it dead in its tracks before it gets going, and that at the end of the day there'll be quite a lot of influence from those U.S. cases that have a lead by as much of a year or more in some instances, that once those dominoes begin to fall, perhaps we'll see some of the same things play out in Canada. Now, whether it works or not, we have seen some governments, or at least one government in Canada, BC, sort of consider the prospect of legislation to try to help facilitate essentially greater level of responsibility or liability for some of these companies. That legislation was recently abandoned, but why don't we start by talking a bit about what did BC have in mind when they first proposed some legislation here?
Yeah, this is a fascinating development. So in March of this year, BC's Attorney General tabled the Public Health Accountability and Cost Recovery Act. And this does for social media what earlier legislation in BC did for tobacco manufacturers. It allows the government to sue makers of allegedly harmful products without having to prove causation of harm to the people who use the products. And it does so by establishing a presumption of causation. So the earlier tobacco bill, which contained the same presumption, withstood a constitutional challenge at the Supreme Court of Canada in 2005. And so, emboldened by this, BC passed another bill in 2018 to go after opioid makers, again, in a bill that contained the same presumption. So this new bill goes even further, and it goes so far that some are wondering if it will withstand a challenge. It allows the government to sue a company for any health-related wrong. That's a defined term in the act, which is any tortious conduct that contributes to disease, injury, or illness. So it's possibly anything. And like the two other bills, it creates a presumption of harm. So there's a section of the Act that says that in an action against a party, the court must presume that the product at issue caused or contributed to disease, injury, or illness. So it, and then, the company would have to rebut the presumption on a balance of probability. But the starting position is that you're guilty. You know that if we can point to harms or that you contributed to harm in some way, then you've got to prove you didn't, that you shouldn't be held responsible. So, but interestingly here, although the bill speaks in these general terms, in its press release following the tabling of the bill, the government explicitly framed it as targeting social media. The press release said this: the legislation provides a way for government to go after social media companies for the harms their algorithms cause people, especially kids. So it's we can come to the policy implications of that, but so that was on the table a month ago.
That was certainly how it was framed, certainly in the media, and how the government sought to promote this as being very much focused on the social media companies themselves. But just in the last number of days, the government seems to have backtracked and talking instead about a self-regulatory approach instead, or at least discussions with the companies in the hope that the companies will act. What do we know about the government's decision to reverse course on the legislation with respect to these social media companies?
Yeah, it was a surprise. Just, out of the blue, the company or the Attorney General just announced that, well, they're going to table or shelve it for the moment. Apparently, Meta reached out to them first, and TikTok has followed. It's not clear whether others have joined them, but those two potential defendants have reached out and said, look, why don't we negotiate some sort of solution? Why don't we try to address your concerns without going to the extent of passing legislation? So it's only an agreement to enter talks at the moment, and so the bill may well come off the shelf and be passed into law at some point in the near future. The decision to shelve it has drawn both praise and criticism. Some say that social media have by now well demonstrated that they're not capable of regulating themselves. They need a legal cudgel to act in the public interest. But others in the business community here in BC have expressed relief given concerns about how breathtaking the act's sweep was. So that's where things stand. But I just want to sort of emphasize the larger point that I think the real significance of the bill is that it's an expression of a policy position. It's an expression of the view that, yes, social media do cause harm and should be held responsible for it, or that there is a duty of care between social media and an entity other than the user, a state entity, the government, possibly school boards, that sort of thing. So, you know, that's going to be an important backdrop when a court in Ontario or elsewhere in Canada considers this.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. You know, why don't we conclude with this? Because, and just to feed off of that, you know, one of the things that I find interesting about this is that there have been calls, of course, to regulate these companies for quite some time. And we have seen some efforts. You know, in Canada at the federal level, of course, we've had C-11 and C-18 in terms of the contributions some of these companies make. And of course, now there's Bill C-63, the online harms bill, that talks more about what kind of responsibility they have with respect to harm, some of those harms which would fit into this, some of which would not. But it seems both the litigation we're seeing and this aborted for the moment legislative attempt is less about saying we're going to regulate in the conventional way we might think about regulating these companies, basically establishing requirements or regulations about how they operate, and instead sort of say, well, you can choose to operate how you like, but if you create these harms, we want to open the door for liability for the kind of harms that you create. You know, what are some of your thoughts about the sort of the avenue that appears to be emerging, which is one to sort of say we're not getting as detailed perhaps when it comes to regulating what the companies do by government, but instead leaving it in some ways to the courts or other litigants to pressure these companies to engage in change and then to hold them liable where they've failed to do so or where their products have been shown to cause real harm?
You make a great point. I mean, we have these two general kinds of tools in the toolbox. We have tort litigation and we have legislation. And so, you know, with legislation, we say companies should not do X or Y. With litigation, we say, you know, when companies fail to do something to prevent X or Y, they should be held liable. And the bottom line seems to be that we can't anticipate, you know, every possible harm. So there seems to be a place for litigation and for legislation. So we're likely, you know, to continue to have to rely on both. But I think that a primary source of harm here is algorithmic feeds and their default status. And I would like to, like, I think the litigation here is important. Maybe one other little detail we should address or mention is that we haven't heard the response, right? And so, I mean, you and I, and I'm sure your listeners, we are well aware of the phenomena where you read a Supreme Court of Canada case and, you know, you read the majority decision and you're absolutely convinced, oh my goodness, yeah, that's absolutely it. They got it right. Then you read the dissent, you think, oh my goodness, wow, that's even more convincing. And then you don't know what to think. And so similarly here, like we may well get, you know, a set of defenses that persuade us otherwise, but setting aside the importance of litigation as a venue, I think that there's still a role for legislation to play here. I think legislation, I would like to see Canada pass legislation that compels social media to allow users to opt out of algorithmic feeds or control what user data they can draw on. I think Parliament should follow the EU, California, and a host of other states' legislation to do just this, to give you either a choice to opt out or to make rules about how algorithms can be designed and function. One vehicle to do this in Canada might have been the Online Harms Act, but it's probably too late for that given where the act is. Another possibility is the AI and Data Act. This is going to require, as I'm sure you know, greater transparency around content recommender algorithms. And it'll involve risk reduction measures if social media algorithms are deemed high impact systems under the act. So maybe, if so, that would reduce the prevalence of biased content or the boosting of harmful content, but it wouldn't necessarily target the design of the platform or the algorithm, the use of algorithms as addictive. It wouldn't, like, it wouldn't allow the government to say you need to make algorithmic feeds optional or control what user data they can use. I think that's a missing piece in Canadian legislation, and I'd like to see that. And I don't see it coming out of the legislation. Maybe, maybe it comes out of settlements, but it's still unclear.
Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, that's interesting, and I think you're right. The focus on algorithms, which we've seen in a number of other legislative contexts, is, I think, where for many, I think the rubber hits the road. This is a fast-moving area where, I think the growing concern about the implications of these services has only been heightened in recent months, certainly. And to see this play out both legislatively and now in the courts makes for a really fascinating area. And you've done a fantastic job, I think, of breaking down what we're seeing on the within the courts. So thanks so much for joining me, taking the time to join me on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Michael.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.